Okay, so now I'm also starting to talk a little bit about individual supernovae, but in a different context. So I don't care about the heat and radiation. I care about cosmic rays and what they do to the ISM, and in particular, if you look at slightly larger scales, how they drive or how they start driving outflows. This is mainly work that I did together with Thorsten Naab, Steffi Walch, and Michael Hanasch. So to start with, why cosmic rays? Why are they important? So first of all, what are cosmic rays? These are high energy particles with non-thermal energies. They're mostly protons. They are smaller fractions of electrons and heavier nuclei. And they have a comparable energy density to the magnetic energy and the thermal energy of the galaxy. And why do we care about them? So first of all, because they have a comparable energy density and because they have different interaction processes. So it's not, cosmic rays do not just join the general ISM soup, but they have different transport processes, and with that we can have a different impact in the ISM. So first, to give a short overview, I guess everyone has seen this cosmic ray flux spectrum, which is a remarkable power law over many, many orders of magnitude, but it's a very steep power law, which means if you look at the total energy in that spectrum, this is only sitting here around 1 GeV. You have here particles with insane energies, but there are only a handful of them. So if we want to look at the global dynamical impact, we have to care about cosmic rays of the order of 1 GeV. In order to see, another thing is where do they come from? So below roughly 1 GeV, we find those conditions roughly in thermal conditions in supernova shells, so for the low energy cosmic rays. If we go up to like 10 to the 15 EV, we think they are of galactic origin, mainly due to shock acceleration. And if we go to the very high energetic cosmic rays, we think they must be of extragalactic origin, but I won't go into detail there.
What is the typical energy of cosmic rays from the sun?
From the sun? Ooh, that's a good question. I don't know.
Probably below 1 GeV.
Yeah, so below a few hundred MeV, the cosmic rays measurements are significantly modified by solar modulation. So anything below 200 MeV, you have to take its effects into account, even at a few hundred MeV. So the spectrum varies.
Okay, so if we talk about shock acceleration, the strongest shocks that we have around in many of them are supernova shells, and there are a few stable models that predict how cosmic rays are accelerated in these supernova shells. It's diffusive shock acceleration in a linear version, and then an extension in a nonlinear version. And the acceleration of cosmic rays depends on the individual shock properties. So the Mach number of the shock, the density, then the temperature, and the magnetic field. How this is done precisely is a very complicated process. So there are people who do individual particle in cell simulation. So you have a shock in your gas, and then you shoot individual cosmic rays and follow their trajectory in order to see how those cosmic rays gain energy and can escape the shock region and transport energy to some other regions. This, for instance, work done by Gargel and Spikowski 2 years ago. Here you see the particle numbers as a function of energy, so how the spectrum looks like for different shock properties, and you see some thermal broad contribution, and depending on the shock properties, you build up a power law with higher and higher energies for stronger shocks. So the main point here is that depending on the shock properties, the spectrum of the cosmic ray differs. And that's important later on. Okay, perhaps I skip this to speed up the talk a little bit. To see how cosmic rays travel through the interstellar medium, I do a simple picture. And if you just imagine you have one individual magnetic field line and you have one charged particle, then this charged particle will gyrate around the magnetic field line. And you can ask, what is the typical radius, the gyro radius at which this particle gyrates around the field line? And of course, this depends on the momentum of the particle, and it depends on the magnetic field energy. But if you look at even very high energy cosmic ray particles, so this is, by the way, the range that is supposed to be the interesting energy range, from like 10 to the minus 2 roughly up to 10 to the 3, then the spectrum is way too steep that the energy doesn't matter anymore. But even if you have 1,000 GeV and a very weak magnetic field, the characteristic gyro radius will be of the order of 100 AU, so very small. What you can do with that assumption, or with that physics, you can say the mean free path of a charged particle is very, very small. It's not as small as a gas particle. A gas particle would hit the next gas particle immediately, a thermal particle. But for those cosmic ray particles, the characteristic radius and the mean free path is rather short compared to the scales we are interested in. We saw the supernova explosion in the previous talk were on scales like 10 parsecs, 20 parsecs, so that's way above this driver radius. That's why people came up with the idea of a fluid approach. So you do not treat the cosmic rays as individual particles and follow the trajectories, but you say the effective mean free path, which is something like the gyro radius, is small compared to the computational cell, then you can use a fluid approach, a classical fluid approach. So if the particles travel or gyrate only about around the magnetic field lines, that's a very idealized picture, and the truth looks much more complicated. So in fact, these relativistic particles also travel perpendicular to the field line via diffusive effects, highly nonlinear effects. And what you can do is you can work out the net diffusive effects, or the net speed at which particles can not just gyrate but also jump between the field lines, so to speak. This is very complicated, and I don't go into the details here, but what you can work out is diffusion coefficient, which is of the order of 10 to the 28 centimeters per, where centimeters should there be? A second. And first of all, this number is very large, so cosmic rays diffuse very fast. And the diffusion coefficient depends on the energy of the particles. Another complication is that the diffusion perpendicular to the field lines is, of course, a different one than parallel to the field lines. So the diffusion coefficient depends on the position in space, mainly because it depends on the direction of the magnetic field. So numerically, the nasty thing is that you cannot use common tricks to solve this second order differential equation, as you could do, for instance, with gravity. Gravity is also, the Poisson equation is also a second order differential equation. But the nice thing about the gravitational constant is that it's constant in space and time. So it has a simple Green's function, and you can use a simple tree to sum up all contributions. But the Green's function for this diffusion is horribly complicated, so you have to do it in a much more complicated way.
I know I'm missing something very simple, but this k, the units are.
Centimeter square. Yeah, sorry. Centimeter square, yeah.
It's like, that's a really big number, so sorry.
Yeah. So, yeah, and what people think, this is with large uncertainty, but that the parallel diffusion coefficient is roughly 10 to 100 times larger than the perpendicular one. okay, how does this now couple to the gas? So if we assume ideal MHD, then the magnetic field lines are frozen within the gas. So the gas, whenever the gas moves, the magnetic field lines move with it. If now the cosmic rays are also coupled to the field lines, of course with some diffusion, but mainly the bulk is coupled to the field lines, then you couple the cosmic rays to the gas via the magnetic field lines, which gives you the fact that cosmic rays are, the bulk of the cosmic rays are advected with the gas, and in addition to that, you have the diffusion with respect to the gas. This is, you can sum up this in an effective advection diffusion approximation, where you have E here, the total, that's the cosmic ray energy. So you have a simple advection of the cosmic ray energy. Then you have a compression, an effect due to compression of the gas. If cosmic rays are confined to the gas and you compress the gas, then you also expect that you push energy into the cosmic rays. Then you have the anisotropic diffusion and some source terms, for instance, in supernova shocks. So far, so good. But so far, we only talked about cosmic rays as one fluid. But this is just, I repeated that equation. The diffusion tensor depends on the energy. So what you want to do if you want to compute the interaction with cosmic rays, between cosmic rays and gas, you do not just want to solve this one equation with one diffusion coefficient for one energy here, but what you want to do is you want to split up the cosmic ray energy into the different parts depending on the energy of the cosmic rays. Because we saw that although the cosmic ray spectrum that is important for dynamical effects is rather small, it still covers 5 orders of magnitude in the case that I showed here. And for 5 orders of magnitude, you have the diffusion coefficient ranging about 2.5 orders of magnitude. And in addition, the cosmic ray spectrum doesn't look simple depending on the shock properties, so you also expect quite a different number of cosmic rays for the low energy part and the high energy part. So that's why we want to solve several cosmic ray energy bins. If you do that, then you also have to include adiabatic gains and losses between these energy bins. I'm not going into detail there. So this all included into the gas equations and coupled the cosmic rays to the gas is now done, and I put it on archive. So this.
Is there some sort of flux limit? Like, can it be saturated? When you have a K, you know, grad E is gigantic. Does that max out? And what's the physics of it?
Yes. So the simple diffusion equation is non physical. So you can in principle, if you just solve a diffusion equation, you have a part of the energy that is diffusing with infinite speeds, basically, or with very large speeds, not taking into account that C could be a limit or so. But the bulk of the energy is moving with reasonable speeds. Here I don't put in a special limiter, because in practical purposes it's not needed here. But of course, if you are picky about the details and the full distribution in the diffusion equation, then you have to put in an additional limit. Okay, let's now go to some tests and sort of a realistic setup in a similar environment as we've seen before. So this first a homogeneous box with a homogeneous magnetic field. Then I have a homogeneous box with a tangled magnetic field. And the more interesting case is sort of a self-consistently created ISM structure where I have a density structure, which is caused by initial turbulence and self-gravity, and the magnetic field configuration, which evolves self-consistently with the collapse and the turbulent motions. Pardon?
Is this SPH?
No, this is a grid code. This is I use Flash for those simulations. So if you now put a supernova in the center and you ask how is the cosmic ray energy evolving, then we see here 10 kilo years after the supernova explosion, how the different energy ranges of the cosmic rays diffuse. And the diffusion coefficient for the high energy cosmic rays is largest. So after 10 kilo years, you already have not really uniform, but fairly well distributed cosmic ray energy for the high energy cosmic rays. Whereas for the low energy cosmic rays, you clearly see that they follow more or less the structure of the magnetic field with highly anisotropic behavior. Which is not surprising, because if the diffusion coefficient is highly non-isotropic and the magnetic field lines are not completely tangled but have some larger coherent structure, it's not tricky to expect that the cosmic rays move mainly along their field lines.
So when you put in a supernova, you're creating cosmic rays as well, right?
Yes, so...
What assumption, I mean, are you doing the diffusive shock acceleration in there, or just injecting them by fiat?
So far, we are only injecting them in the center of the supernova with a given spectrum. Okay. We have the tools to detect the shock properties and then put in a spectrum accordingly. But first of all, you need a very high resolution to properly capture the shock properties. And this is also then a problem with numerical stability. If you inject additional high energy only in that very thin shock layer of a couple cells. So for the first tests, we switch that off and just put in the supernova region some cosmic rays.
So is it a finite region inside the supernova, or where you put the...
You have
a source, right? And then you have diffusion. So what would the source look like?
Well, the source is initially just a spherical region of roughly also 5 parsecs, where we put in thermal energy plus cosmic ray energy. Of course, this is not entirely true for the cosmic rays, because the cosmic rays are generated in the shock region and are not located in the interior part. But more sophisticated models show that the majority of cosmic rays first moves into the supernova shell region and only a smaller fraction out of the supernova shell region. So you end up, even with the more sophisticated models, you end up having more cosmic rays in the interior part that slowly diffuse out. So we are, by accident, not too far off. One simple result of that diffusion at different velocities, diffusion speeds, is that the spectra that you observe at different positions or at different distances from the supernova look really different. So if you have a supernova explosion and you ask what is the impact, let's say ionization rates, or what are what's the gamma ray luminosity at a certain point, then the assumption of an isotropic diffusion and a constant spectrum everywhere is highly violated, because first of all, the magnetic field lines gives you directions where the cosmic rays move faster, plus the high energy cosmic rays reach a certain point earlier, which means all the spectra built up from the high energy part, because those cosmic rays move there first, and then slowly the low energy cosmic rays come after that and finally reconstruct the classical spectrum that you would observe. So if you want to do a time analysis and ask how are nearby clouds affected by cosmic rays, the spectra are complicated and the time evolution is complicated. So we know that the cosmic ray energy diffuses somewhere. The question is, are they important? And how important are they? If we want to have a dynamical impact, then we want to know what would be the acceleration of the gas due to cosmic rays. That's why we can have a look at the ratio of the cosmic ray pressure gradient, which will be the acceleration due to cosmic rays, over the gradient of the gas pressure gradient. And here are plots for three different points in time, 10, 50, and 150 kiloyears after the supernova explosion. And the two color regions indicate this ratio. So for very for dark red regions, this is a factor of 100. For the very blue, it's 1 over 100. And you see that in these regions where the cosmic rays can diffuse, the cosmic ray pressure gradient is more than 2 or 3 orders of magnitude higher than the gas pressure gradient. You nicely see the supernova shell, and of course within the shell, the gas pressure dominates. But because cosmic rays can diffuse and are not only advected with the gas, they can travel far ahead of the supernova shock front and accelerate the gas here.
Something that wasn't, I mean, I just know very little about this, but when you're making the cosmic rays, you have to take some time to accelerate them.
Yes.
You're assuming just that they already diffuse, but I guess they would have to be made and then...
Yes, so you have to assume some time, and I don't know precisely how long that time is, but it's short compared to the overall evolution of the supernova remnant, or the expansion of the supernova remnant.
Now that's a statement that depends on the density of the ambient medium, right? Because if the medium is very, very dense, the supernova basically does radiative very quickly. And then if it's very low density, the shock can go for a very long time and accelerate with the high energies. So I think that this statement is probably okay for this regime.
But as Chambers said, the velocity, when the shock dies, the velocity is about the same.
As it continues on, the acceleration continues to go on as the shock speed as it coasts. So basically, I mean, the setup.
The velocity is pretty small at that point.
There are two issues. There might be a confusion. There are two things. One is the maximum energy of the cosmic rays. The maximum energy of the cosmic rays is dictated by the size of the largest structure at the time that the structure dissolves into the ISM, regardless of its velocity. That's the maximum energy. But the total energy, usually in these diffusive shock acceleration models, which are usually the 1D ones that I'm thinking of that are doing the global evolution of supernovas, the shock acceleration, which are just using assumptions about what the peak codes would return on the microphysical scale, those mostly put all their. They put 10%, but that time that they put it on the set-off time, roughly speaking. So the set-off time is of order, 10 kiloyears is the time at which about a tenth of the energy would be in cosmic rays. And that's sort of regardless of the fact that, 50 or 100 or 1,000 kiloyears later, they're going to eventually be, one particle of 10 to the 16 UV.
I was thinking of what produces the highest energy cosmic rays, because I've done some work on this years ago.
So you also have, I guess one thing I'm wondering about is this question of the diffusion speed not being limited, because it looks like, they've gone along the magnetic field, they've gone 40 parsecs, in 40 kiloyears, so that's 1,000 kilometers a second, so that's pretty fast.
It's close to what if you were going to impose a physically motivated limiter, then it wouldn't be the speed of light, it would be the Alfvén speed along a direction, because as the particles approach the Alfvén speed, if Helen's Weibull was here, she would say that the resonant makes site magnetic perturbations that would then scatter them. So you're actually close to that.
Well, it depends on what the medium is, but the Alfvén speed might be a lot lower.
It
probably lower than 3,000 kilometers per second. It looks like your maximum speed is about 3,000 kilometers per second.
So, but with these high diffusion coefficients, we are basically on a lower limit concerning the cosmic ray impact. So I tested a couple diffusion coefficients, and the slower or the lower the diffusion coefficient is, the longer the cosmic rays stick around and the longer they have time to accelerate the gas.
Yeah. Right, so you're being conservative, actually. But it's also, it may be more, I guess it may also be more spatially correlated with Earth gases because it doesn't escape so easily.
So here's basically a similar picture here. I compare the run without cosmic rays with 10% cosmic rays, and just to play with the numbers, with 30% cosmic rays. And you can see color-coded is the total acceleration of the gas. In black lines, you see the magnetic field lines. And in white lines, you see the gradient of, or the direction of the acceleration. And here you have some sort of, if you look in particular in that region, sort of random orientation of the acceleration. If the cosmic ray energy travels along the field lines, then the gradient is strongest perpendicular to the field lines, and the acceleration of the gas is mainly here perpendicular to the field lines. If you put in even more energy, that picture doesn't change, just the acceleration gets a bit higher.
Cosmic ray clear out the gas along the magnetic field line, then it will eventually, the supernova will expand toward that region of diffusion.
Yes, so the acceleration points toward that direction, but the problem here is that the time scales are relatively short. So to see a really big effect on the gas, you have to wait for long enough, or you have to have multiple supernovae. So if you just put one supernova in a galactic disk, the cosmic rays don't do much. So here it points towards a strong acceleration, stronger than the gas acceleration, but the diffusion is also pretty strong, so the cosmic rays can also travel away fast enough and the acceleration drops after a certain time. So in order to see a large-scale effect on the dynamics, you would have to wait longer or take more supernovae. And this is...
So the magnetic field, I don't completely understand what you're showing the magnetic field inside the ring.
Oh, so...
Is this an average along the line of sight?
Oh, this is just a slice. This is just a slice.
If it's a slice, then why is the magnetic field compressed at the edge?
Well, so I didn't plot the magnetic field strength. I'm not sure. The magnetic field lines here are plotted on very low resolution. So if I go to the shock region itself and I would plot the magnetic field lines here with higher resolution, then the picture looks different. Also, there's magnetic field lines coming out and going in. This is just a stupid slice. So I wouldn't draw conclusions from these five cells here.
Okay.
Perhaps let me skip this part and go to some larger scales. So now we go away from this one individual supernova, but go to a galactic disk and see what cosmic rays can do on larger scales. There's been done some work before. For instance, Michael Hanasch published a paper last year where he simulated an entire galaxy, including magnetic fields, and he put in wherever you have star formation, so when regions become dense enough, he puts in cosmic rays, but only cosmic rays. And the disk itself is kept isothermally. That's, of course, far away from real physics, but what he wants to show, or what they want to show, is that only putting in cosmic rays can already be enough energy to drive a galactic wind. So by putting in only cosmic rays, no thermal input, they reach mass loading factors that are around unity or higher. So this is the evolution in time. Here they show the star formation rate and the outflow rates at different heights. So that's at 2 kiloparsecs, 10 and 50 kiloparsecs. And for, of course, 2 kiloparsecs, just above the plane more or less, you have a high output rate or large mass loading factor. And if you go to larger and larger scale height, this drops. But still, with just cosmic rays, you can push the gas significantly away from the disk.
It must depend on the magnetic field geometry.
So, what is the so initially, the field geometry is within the disk, and then in certain locations where the field lines break up, then the cosmic rays can stream along those field lines and push the gas out. So the magnetic field configuration is pretty complicated after a short time of the evolution, and you have magnetic field lines really pointing away from the disk at larger distances. There's another work by Salem, who also simulated an entire galaxy. They put in thermal energy plus cosmic rays. Unfortunately, they have no magnetic field, so the diffusion is here an isotropic diffusion, but they also have a similar conclusion. So the cosmic rays, first of all, they suppress star formation because the cosmic ray gas doesn't cool as efficiently as the thermal gas, and they also see that they have some winds. And the third example by Booth et al. From last year, they simulated also an entire galaxy with two different masses, so and two different spatial scales. They also put in supernova with thermal and cosmic ray feedback. They also have an isotropic diffusion, no magnetic field, and they come basically to the same conclusion. The wind here, they show, or the mass loading factor is depends on the total on the size of the system and the mass of the system, but they see in both cases that cosmic rays can drive gas up to very large heights. Okay, so I tried the same, but on smaller scales, so ranging from smaller scales up to like a couple kiloparsecs, but with more physics and with more concentrating on the ISM. So what I did, together with the SILC collaboration, that's a number of people from the university in Prague, then from Heidelberg, Cologne, and Zurich, and also with Mordecai McLow, we simulated a part of a disk, a stratified box of that size, first without cosmic rays and now with cosmic rays, and we go to plus and minus 20 kiloparsecs. We varied the surface densities but started with something like Milky Way conditions. Within the galactic disk, we have a chemical network which follows the hydrogen species and also CO and C+. Following Glover in 2010. Then we have shielding and self-shielding of various species following the tree call algorithm by Clark and a new updates on the how to solve the gravity and the shielding by Richard Wünsch. So, and here I want to compare two simulations. One without cosmic rays. So here you see the density, the column density, the temperature, and the magnetic field. So you see supernova go off in random places. You see that the disk is rather thin. Every now and then you have a supernova that pushes hot gas or some material above the disk plane, but nothing really spectacular. This is not surprising. The supernova rate here is rather low, and we only evolve the system for a rather short time, so we don't expect like huge effects.
How low and how short?
So this goes up to like 50 or 100 mega years.
And the supernova rate is?
The supernova rate is like, it's around the Kenny-Kaschmidt supernova rate.
What's the surface density?
The surface density is 10 solar masses per square parsec. And that for our volume, that gives us 10 supernovae per mega year, roughly.
What's the resolution?
This resolution is now 8 parsec.
What's the bit?
AMR?
Pardon?
Do you use the AMR?
Yes, we use AMR, but effectively all that part is fully refined.
So what? Okay.
So but I have to say we... 8
parsec resolution is what you're saying.
So for the simulations we did with the SILT collaboration without cosmic rays, we ran it with the 4 parsecs resolution, so one AMR level higher, and for much longer time. But now what I do with cosmic rays, because of the expensive runs, I reduce the resolution for now and run the simulations, well, as far as I could. I have to say that when I came here, those simulations were not really running. So I got the 2 slides later, I got them over the weekend. So I have to see how far I can tune resolution and things like that. Okay, anyway, this disk is rather thin. If we now run the same with cosmic rays, this is the cosmic ray energy, the other panels are the same. Then you see that the disk quickly gains in size. You see that the diffusion of cosmic rays can push the gas out of the disk, and because this fluid doesn't cool, there's an acceleration that sticks around for much longer. And you see that the disk is much more extended. The ISM looks different. So you have different structures. I haven't analyzed that in detail, but overall you see a direct immediate net effect on the amount of gas that can flow out and the thickness of the disk.
If you have a horizontal magnetic field.
Initially I have a horizontal
magnetic field here. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So the magnetic field is initially horizontal, and yeah, I don't fix it, so it's not forced to have a main component always along within the disk.
Have you compared the pressure of cosmic rays with kinetic, dynamic pressure in the disk?
Yeah, so magnetic. Within the disk, the cosmic rays are the smaller contribution. So then the gas dominates the direct evolution. So if you made the same plot with comparing the pressures and the pressure gradient, then the thermal or the kinetic part, in particular also the turbulent part in the medium and in the supernova regions, that dominates. But once the cosmic rays go to those lower energies, then the cosmic ray contribution increases dramatically.
So will it be, dominating then when the disk gets thicker? Is it just due to cosmic rays, or are those different components still comparable? I mean, this turbulence versus cosmic rays versus magnetic field.
So the thermal and the turbulent component, they are almost the same, with or without cosmic rays. But because the supernova are the same, it's the same number, and the chemistry network is the same. So apart from some regions that cool less efficient, the thermal contribution will also be similar. But then you have the additional component of the cosmic rays. I don't know. I cannot give you numbers right now, in particular, because ideally you would want to run that with high resolution for full disk for a long time, so that you have some consistent background cosmic ray energy density and then the additional contribution. I can't. So there's no way, even if I wait 2 more weeks, this would not solve the problem. Right? I cannot run that for 500 mega years, 700.
And these simulations haven't reached a steady state yet, have they?
Not yet. But the disk seems to expand and explode here, but it doesn't. So for the disk height, there's some bouncing effects, but sort of a steady state.
Yeah. But he'll have this oscillatory period. And I mean, we found a box like this with MHD. We actually got vertical oscillations with exactly the time scale that Tom Cox predicted with the steam of the 1D simulation. So I'd be curious to see what your oscillatory periods are. But it's all on Hill, Alex Hill's paper.
Okay, so a quick look at the mass loading factors. Here I compare the non-cosmic ray run to the cosmic ray run at 0.75 kiloparsecs. That's all I could do for now. And you see that there's a significant increase in outflow. This is for a smaller star formation rate. If you go to the star formation rate, which is consistent to Kennicott-Schmidt, then this simulation even ran less far, but you also see that there are spikes where gas is pushed a little bit by supernova and then transported away by cosmic rays. So you see spikes in the outflows, and it seems to give a consistent picture that cosmic rays can push gas to higher distances. So in the...
this gas isn't unbalanced, just...
Not really, no. So you would have to see, so the cosmic ray energy can travel easily up to like 10 kiloparsecs or 20 kiloparsecs, and you would have to see what happens with the gas that is accelerated from that point. So not the significant difference with cosmic rays is not that you have to launch the outflow from within the disk. You only have to provide some gas that comes out of the disk, and then the cosmic rays can provide acceleration far above the disk. And that's the completely different picture compared to a supernova explosion, because a supernova explosion has to accelerate the gas within the few parsecs that you showed us before. So perhaps I jump to this.
But going back to it, that's exactly what you're showing here, is that the acceleration, you know, if it's really reaching,
yeah, this
600 kilometers a second.
So let's go first to this plot. This is the acceleration, the net acceleration that I get on the gas as a function of height. So here is zero, so that's the midplane. And here, at that snapshot, the cosmic rays traveled up to roughly like 15 kiloparsec. And of course, what you see is, you see strong variations, but you see that the net acceleration of the gas tends to be a little bit lower, or at least not larger, a couple kiloparsecs just above the plane compared to like 10 kiloparsecs above the plane. So, of course, here's little gas, but that gas is efficiently accelerated by the cosmic rays. And then we go one slide back and have a look what the net velocities show. And you see, due to this continuous acceleration, this low density gas here can be accelerated to relatively high velocities. So this is consistent with for instance, Michael Hanasch did, he also finds that the gas is accelerated at larger heights to significant speeds. You get slightly different values, but overall, this is gives a consistent picture.
So it is a, it may be.
That would be
a thing. I didn't have a physical picture in mind when I was watching your simulations. It took me a while to connect things going on in the gas distribution with the cosmic ray distribution. I don't mean for you to go back to the movie, but it does seem like you have your supernova, you know, that go off, and then sometime later, there's almost like a nearly spherical input of energy and cosmic rays above the plane.
Right, right. Right. So what we have, we put the supernova in random places, but we put in 25% as type 1A supernovae with a larger scale height. And the other supernovae we put in partially clustered environments. So sometimes you see this a 1A going off basically above the plane, and that causes this cosmic ray injection.
Okay, so how much of this acceleration is actually caused by cosmic rays from the 1As versus?
I would say they don't differ by much, because for the cosmic rays it only takes very little time to diffuse from within the plane out of the plane. Right? So this picture is this color scale is a bit misleading, because it shows the cosmic ray energy unit mass. So it shows how much impact the cosmic rays have per unit mass. If you show it per unit volume, then you see that this distribution quickly reaches an almost uniform distribution. And whether you launch a supernova exactly here or just within a dense region, for the cosmic rays, it doesn't make a big difference. Not a huge difference. So I would not say that the outflows are mainly driven by type 1A. They have a better position, but the cosmic rays can diffuse so quickly, so it's not the main contribution. Okay, and I think I come to my conclusions. So what we see is that on small scales, that cosmic rays quickly diffuse through the ISM along the magnetic field lines with different energies and different speeds. So the time evolution around the supernova remnant is important, and the spatial details. We see, I skipped that cosmic rays can increase the kinetic energy ahead of the shell because they diffuse faster and can accelerate the gas ahead of the shell. Mainly, the acceleration of gas due to cosmic rays is strong in low-density environments. The diffusion itself doesn't care, apart from some more physical complications. The diffusion process itself doesn't care whether it's now a denser region or less dense region. So then naturally, the gradients compared to the thermal gas gradients are larger in low-density regions. And this is also important if we go to higher altitudes. The acceleration details and also the ionization depend strongly on the cosmic ray source spectrum. So what we have to put in is a cosmic ray spectrum according to the real shock properties in order to see how fast the individual cosmic rays, or what the contribution is from one GeV cosmic rays compared to the lower energy cosmic rays, and in particular for the ionization, which depends mainly on the low energy cosmic rays because of the cross section. If you're interested, you can talk to me later. So there the cosmic ray source spectrum is important. And finally, without a full detailed analysis, we see that cosmic rays have enough energy to drive outflows. Thanks.
I was trying to think of observable ramifications of these ideas. And the first one is, the reason Alex Hill did these simulations that he did was to try to recreate the warm ionized medium, because I don't think people realize that I don't think there's any model that creates an ionized layer that has a scale of 1 kiloparsec at 10 to the 4 degrees. So we tried to do it with just magnetic fields and it failed. I'm sure Alex, when you're done with it, Alex would love to get. Well, I mean, what we did is with Mordecai, right? We put in the similar simulations with magnetic fields, in the hope that the magnetic field would add an additional pressure support that could support the ionized layer, the gas higher, and it didn't. As I mentioned the other day, right? We got the same vertical density structure, even though we had more magnetic pressure. The magnetic tension terms canceled it out and left us with the same vertical density.
Well, I guess there's two reasons. One is the spatial distribution, but the other is the ionization.
Well, first of all, we just figured out what's the density structure, and then actually Alex in a separate paper looked at the radiative transfer through that to see if we could ionize it too. But at any rate, so we failed. I mean, we didn't get a thick, a layer that's that thick with that density. And so, you know, when you guys get done with it, I'm sure you would love to do synthetic observations of your simulations.
So I played around with the diffusion coefficients and the supernova rate and various other processes, and you can easily tune that model to completely disrupt the disk. Mm-hmm. That's no problem. So if you put if you choose the diffusion coefficients too low, then there is a continuous input in energy that cannot diffuse away, that does not cool fast enough, because the cooling times for the cosmic rays of GeV are too long. So you accumulate energy there, the pressure gradients get bigger and bigger, and the 10 solar mass disk per square parsec is easy to disrupt. Even if you put in a stronger external potential that keeps stuff down and all these tricks. So with them, it's easy to make a disk explode.
So it's flexible.
Yeah.
So the other idea is, I mean, is it possible that the cosmic rays, I mean, your cosmic rays diffuse away from your remnants. Could they hit molecular clouds that weren't immediately adjacent? I mean, that might be another observable signature. If molecular clouds are lighting up in cosmic rays near a supernova remnant, but not right next to it. I mean, that could be something that could be tested. So.
Yes. So you would probably test that with my first kind of setup, where you have one supernova where you can control how far away you put a molecular cloud and follow the chemistry self consistently with what we have in there. And put in the ionization rates, which so far I haven't done. I haven't coupled the ionization rates in the chemistry with the cosmic ray energy density, but you could do that.
Do you have cosmic ray disruption, ion production, and photons, cosmic ray protons experience ion production?
So far we don't.
Okay, one test of this would be to take the product of your local cosmic ray energy density and then matter density and just look at what the vertical distribution of gamma ray emissivity would be, because this is extremely well understood from Galprop. I knew Andrew Strong and most like the Galprop code and Fermi distribution. So those are things that are pretty easy to compare to see if it's.
But For pion production, you need at least cosmic rays with 1 GeV.
You need above the pion resonance, so above a few hundred MeV.
Yes, but usually the efficiency with which you generate those pions give you, as far as I understood, a net energy that needs to be roughly around or above 1 GeV because the. Yeah, around that. We changed the spectrum a bit, but we put the peak in different positions. So if you have simple shock acceleration models, they predict an E to the minus 2 spectrum. So we changed that. And in one of the models, we have the peak at 1 GeV, but that could only at maximum destroy half of the energy, or not even half.
Yeah, well, you can
yeah,
just,
sure.
Because the scale height of the gamma ray is a little low.
But I think it also can put a limit on the, you don't have a screen anyway. lifetime of the cosmic ray is limited by the time.
Yes, there's lots of things to improve. So destruction of cosmic rays, we should modify the diffusion coefficient, we should put in streaming, but now that the full code is working with the spectral resolution and the advection and everything, these other source terms are sort of easy to implement, I hope.
It's very good. It's very nice.
Can you compare the turbulent energy in two cases? How much more strong the turbulence is in these cosmic rays?
I can show you probably tomorrow. If you stop by my office, I can tell you.